tell the American people the truth. The American people, I think, actually have a pretty high tolerance for hard truths.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and this is the Editor's Roundtable. Today, I'm joined by FP contributor Rosa Brooks, Senior Future of War Fellow at New America Foundation and professor at Georgetown University. Also with me is another FP columnist, Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. This is different for us. It's just going to be the three of us and no outside guests, so we can speak more candidly.
We can say what we really think.
We can say what we really think, exactly, not be intimidated by them. I thought I would start with January 20th, 2017.
Nobody heard that. Is that your birthday, David? Nobody
heard Corey's stomach rumble. We just stopped speaking because Corey's stomach rumbled in a really disturbing.
Move along, folks. Move along.
You know, we are here in the FP studio. We are all eating leftover Halloween candy, so we're gonna share the remaining two milk duds between the three of us.
Right. Although this podcast could have been recorded at any time on Halloween.
Recovery.
The Halloween leftovers last for about 4 months. Yeah.
That's morally wrong. Halloween leftover candy should be sifted through like wildfire.
This is the kind of division, the kind of intellectual discourse that this podcast depends on. No, January 20th, 2017 is the day the next president will take office. Hey, Corey, were you the next president? What would you do to reboot U.S. foreign policy? What are the three most important things the next president of the United States needs to do on the foreign policy front, first 100 days kind of thing?
The first thing is stop saying things we don't mean as a way to begin restoring American credibility.
Can you give us an example?
President Obama at the United Nations General Assembly, in speaking about Syria, says, as everyone knows, America will always do its part.
Oh, right.
You think we should instead say, as everyone knows, America will sometimes do its part, and at other times we will shirk, I say to you now.
This is what I like.
We're suggesting that very clearly.
The Shockey Brooks administration will be the first one in history to speak the truth on foreign policy.
There you go. I am opposed to speaking the complete truth on foreign policy, but we actually—
Sometimes. Actually, we don't like you that much. We have to deal with you, and we will do so reluctantly unless it's election season.
I'm very grateful for this stalling to buy me time to think of two more things. The first, though, is we need to restore our credibility. We are saying so many things that we don't actually mean. And we ought to just stop doing that. The second thing I would love to see the Brooks presidency, in which I am proud to serve as her vice president, accomplish.
Wait a minute, that's not fair. I don't want to be president.
The president working with Congress and making a public case for policies matters an enormous amount, and it's shocking to me that President Obama has done that so little and so infrequently on the wars we're fighting and on the major national security issues. So we do need to have a conversation with American voters about what we need to do in the world.
So when Hillary Clinton is elected, where are we going to take all the recalcitrant, difficult Republican congresspeople to get them out of the way?
We're going to send them to Syria to fight ISIS.
Which they want to do, evidently.
It works for everybody.
In the halcyon days of American foreign policy that were Jesse Helms chairing the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that Madeleine Albright managed to build a lot of common ground with him on policies that need doing. In fact, there's that one awful picture of the two of them.
But do you know what you're saying, right? You're saying we've come to the point where Jesse Helms, in retrospect, looks like a beacon of reasonability.
Yes! You know, and Madeleine Albright looks like a fantastic Secretary of State.
One of my very first foreign policy assignments when I was a young person working at the U.S. Department of State during the late days of the Clinton administration was to babysit Jesse Helms' staffers while at the United Nations. And my
I thought
job,
you were going to say some of his illegitimate
children. No. Mark Thiessen, who now writes for the Washington Post and was then working for Jesse Helms. And my job was to keep them out of trouble, which is to say to keep them from having their own personal bilateral meetings with foreign leaders by saying things like, oh, the meeting with the Iranian head of state, oh, I don't think that's until 3 o'clock, when it was really at 2 o'clock and things, other devious things.
You did that?
I never told a lie because I'm a very honest person, but that was clearly my assignment, was to do what it took to keep Jesse Helms away from the United Nations. However, I take your point, Corey.
I feel like we can't. A lot of the policy constraints on the president are actually of our own making, for either saying things we don't mean or refusing to build a basis of domestic support for what they think need doing. Jim Mattis and I run a project at the Hoover Institution on civil-military gaps, for which I think I have previously mentioned Rosa wrote a terrific chapter for the book. One of the things that is most striking about American public attitudes on national security issues is how malleable they are to the president making the argument that we need.
Meaning they don't really know what they think.
Yes, they're not Ted Cruz principled, I'll burn this place down rather than compromise to create common policy. Like, people understand that the world's dangerous and complicated, and they expect the president to make sense of it for them and explain to them that what needs doing, we can do, and we're not going to pay a disproportionately high price to do it.
Item number one, walk the walk. Yep. Item number two, hands across the aisle. Item number three.
Item number three. This is getting harder. Each podcast gets a little
Item
tougher.
Number three is build non-military tools of American foreign policy. We have allowed too much stuff to migrate into the Defense Department that is properly civilian activity. And it migrates into the Defense Department because they know how to get stuff done. And we need to actually build stronger levers. The Treasury Department's done a great job on building sanctions levers, but there are a lot of other levers, and we need to get busy.
So here we have what I didn't expect we'd have. We have Corey recommending that we downsize the Pentagon and move those things out and have them done someplace else in the government.
I'm in favor of that.
Rosa?
Okay. Well, I'm going to agree with much of what Corey just said, but disagree with a little bit. And let me start with the disagreement. I don't know what it means to say that certain things ought to be military tasks and certain other things ought to be civilian tasks. You know, these are categories that we created. We can change them. God didn't come down and say, here is a box labeled military that shall only be touched by people wearing uniforms. Here is another box labeled civilians that shall not be touched by those in uniforms. And I think
that's not actually what Mike Huckabee says.
Well, I think we really fetishize the idea that there is a proper civilian lane and a proper military lane. And I think that might have made a certain amount of sense back in the days when it was easy to say, this is a war, this is not a war, this is a weapon, this is not a, when weapons were cannons and bows and arrows, and wars involved massed armies facing each other on an open field, it was relatively easy to distinguish between a civilian task and military task. Today, when quote-unquote weapons are as likely to be in cyberspace or biological in nature or financial and so forth, it's not all that obvious to me that we really have any theory anymore that makes any sense, that's not just arbitrary, about what belongs in the military domain and what belongs in the civilian domain. I would actually rather see us get less fixated on it. So on the one hand, I think it's true that a lot has migrated to the Defense Department and away from the civilian agencies. I don't think the solution to that, though, is necessarily to say, oh, my goodness, we need to migrate it right back again while also building up capacity in the civilian agencies. I think maybe the way to think about it is much more functional to say, what do we need to get done? Which entities can do it? If the answer is nobody is doing it well, what do we need to do? Where will it be least expensive financially and in terms of political costs, which is a different ball of wax, to make sure that we develop those capabilities. So I'm less concerned about where we put them than that we can do them.
But this is a critique of the Shockey administration foreign policy.
However,
where's the Brooks administration?
But I reject the description of my position as fetishizing militarization. But go on.
But fetishizing is a good word, and I had to use it.
You are fetishizing language.
That's true. Okay. But actually, and maybe we should come back to that whole question. But before we do, just since my administration is still in its infancy, I just want to announce my other early initiatives. I think, and this is the Rosa corollary. I never knew how to pronounce
corollary.
That
is corollary.
Corollary. Thank you. The British say corollary, which I can't really say.
Yeah, the British say aluminium.
Yeah. Okay. An advertisement. The Rosa Brooks corollary to the Shockey doctrine of walk the walk, say what you mean, is my corollary to that would be tell the American people the truth. You know. And the American people, I think, actually have a pretty high tolerance for hard truths, in part because they're living it. Things like, look, folks, America's ability to control the world has been declining. You say that and you're a politician right now, you get beat up, you get called a declinist, which is a very mean word to be called in American politics. I think that's absurd, given that poll after poll tells the American people understand very clearly that America's global influence is limited and has declined. And hearing, hey, here's the situation we're in, here's what we're going to do about it, is going to be a lot more useful to people than hearing a bunch of pablum about we're so great, we're so great, we're so great, our military's so great, we're all so great. So telling the truth, including about the limits of American power, both right now and inherently, I think is a pretty vital one. I also think, and this will maybe bring us back to the question of what's civilian, what's military, where should we draw these lines? And this is also a corollary to the Shockey point two, Shockey administration platform two, about working with Congress. Congress is part of the problem in American foreign policy. The way not only all the usual stuff about partisanship and brokenness, but also just the structure of Congress itself, that we have rather rigidly, as you know, divided up responsibility for foreign affairs within Congress between Armed Services Committee, Intelligence Committees, Foreign Affairs Committees, and they don't like each other, and they don't want to play nicely together, and they don't even like having hearings together, because that would mean that somebody who's the chair of one committee can't be in charge and be on TV quite as much in a joint hearing. That's absurd. You know, I think that in our amazing new administration, in addition to just working with Congress, that part of the agenda of what are we doing with Congress is to say, you know, you guys need to figure out a way to tie yourselves to the mast so that America is not perpetually hobbled by this absolutely archaic and dysfunctional system of figuring out what legislation we need, what money we need, where.
But I got to tell you something. I'd be sitting here over at Foreign Policy as your administration took office planning my first column, going, you know, never let wonks take over the running
people
of the government.
Wonks off fires his first flaming arrow.
Yeah, right. And it would be something along the lines of the first three initiatives of the Shockey Brooks administration.
That we're president.
No, I'm all for it. I think it's, you know, high time to go from no women presidents to two at once. But
we could have a triumvirate if you're jealous, David.
Yeah, no.
Works
but,
for Rome.
But what
so
I was
well.
Getting at, no, it didn't work so well. What I was getting at was. That, you know, we've now talked about the character and the process, but we actually haven't talked about any foreign policies, like things that we would do. And this administration, if it sits here doing this, will sink into a...
Oh, he's so nitpicky. He wants details. You want to know things like countries and issues? Is that what you're getting?
Yeah, where are we going to start? What are we going to do? Is there going to be a priority? Does America have a role in the world? Do we just wait for the fire alarm to go off and then we put our coats over our head and sit under our desks to make sure that... You know, the flying glass doesn't get us. You know, aren't there some things that a new president's got to do? Like go on an apology tour of the Middle East and say, hey, you know, sorry about that Obama era. But, you know, those of you who are our friends, you're still our friends. And we're going to do stuff with you to protect you. And those of you who are enemies, We're not going to invade your country necessarily, but if we can help kill you, we will do that. And here's how we're going to do it. Or go to Vladimir Putin and say, no, you know, and roll up a newspaper and hit him across the snout and say, no, you know, and make sure that he believes that you actually say no. Or say, hey, the Atlantic Alliance is really important in counterbalancing Putin and dealing with refugees and dealing with China, and it's broken. We got to fix that. That's item number one. We don't have a Pacific architecture. We need to have one. That's item number two, et cetera. You'd like something.
So I have to say, with apologies to the sisterhood, I am neither voting for myself nor Rosa Brooks. I'm voting for David Rothkopf.
Just the words because, I wanted
because,
to hear.
Because you are completely on top of this, David.
I am now launching my
candidacy. And that sounded like a really good platform.
Thank you.
Particularly the snout part with Putin.
No, anything.
There's too little use of these whack a snout with a newspaper approach.
There's also too little use of mano a mano or womano a womano. I don't know what the terminology would be. Confrontation out there. But, you know, for example, John Kerry plays hockey. Vladimir Putin plays hockey. How about a little one-on-one? Let's resolve this.
Because we know
because,
who would win.
Yes, that's exactly right.
That
this is like that moment in the Iliad when Hector offers to fight any of the Greek heroes to end the war, and Odysseus says, not so fast, we want Paris. He started this, right? Like, this isn't going to end well for us.
I have been waiting for a long time for the Iliad to work its way into our conversation here. And we are really elevating this.
You could not have told me I'm boring in any more direct a fashion.
No. You are wrong. I love the Iliad. It is blood and gore and guts and violence. It's a heck of a tale. Right up until the point that you make Brad Pitt the star. At that point, it just all unravels terribly, apparently.
Homer's not responsible for that choice.
No, that was a terrible choice. Are there any other concrete things that you would do? Are there any other, reach out, new relationship with China, transatlantic trade deal?
So if we're actually required to put policies and priorities on the table, David, as opposed to...
Well, and Barack Obama wasn't, so I don't see why you should be held to a higher standard. But
I feel like the biggest opportunity in foreign policy we are currently missing is closer work with Canada and Mexico. Integration of North American energy.
What she
of North
said.
American.
This is smart.
I feel like that's a huge one that has lots of upside room. But also,
particularly if we hand over control of the U.S. to the Canadians.
The food is better in Mexico.
I am not living in a
Canada.
Government run by Jason Trudeau. I'm just not.
My daughter, who writes for Jezebel, wrote their take on the election of Justin Trudeau. And the headline was, Canada elects a prime minister named Justin, which I thought said it all. She also then in her opening line of her thoughtful political analysis said that he was uncontroversially fuckable.
I was going to say something using slightly different words and
like,
say it's nice to see a hunky prime minister, but I think
but
your
think
daughter.
Of, think of North
are you allowed
America?
To say that, by the way, in a podcast?
Fuckable?
A family podcast?
No,
like
I don't
this
think
one?
You could say fuckable.
Allow me to suggest that John Kerry would probably win the hockey match with Justin Trudeau. So I disagree
so
with
you
both your daughter and Rosa.
So this
on
would
this
be
one?
Interesting. Maybe we
you
should
think,
do the equivalent
you think John
of fantasy
Kerry is
football.
Hotter than Justin Trudeau?
No,
that's
no,
what
no,
it sounds like you're
talk
saying.
Talk about the Red Queen's race.
this is genius. There should be a sort of a fantasy football for foreign policy equivalent.
We are thinking.
No, I so don't want to do this because then they will do the female counterpart
right,
as
I know,
well.
It's
which
true.
Is what? Foreign policy dollhouses?
Glass houses. Foreign policy glass houses, which is what we live
so,
in.
So back to Canada and Mexico, my friends.
But you're right. It's a good point. I think
not
we should concentrate
only,
on our own continent or
there,
hemisphere. Whatever
not only is there a lot of upside that we are failing to take the opportunity of, but there's also a lot of downside. And the losing of control over the southern border of our country and the way that gangs and drug cartels are taking advantage of American gun laws and Mexican drug
transit. So a big foreign policy step forward would be legalizing drugs.
And prohibiting guns.
And prohibiting guns.
The Republican platform, 2016.
I got to say.
You heard it here first,
you wanna
ladies
fix,
and gentlemen.
You want to make America more secure. Legalize drugs and eliminate guns.
Yes.
There is nothing you could do in foreign policy that would save more American lives than those two steps.
Except possibly reduce the speed limit to 20 miles an hour.
I've got an even better idea. Why don't we actually reduce the demand for drugs in
How are
America?
We going to do that? By making life happier? By having everybody get along? People have been trying to reduce the demand for drugs forever. What happens is if you make them legal, then you can regulate them, and you can provide treatment, and you don't have jails that are filled
Let's not get distracted by legalization of drugs arguments, though, because I don't want to. Let's stick with Corey's really good idea, because
which one was that?
Focusing more on this particular hemisphere. I mean, it is interesting. Part of the whole foreign policy puzzle, right, is what is it that we define as a foreign policy problem or crisis? And for the last 15 years, understandably, given the shock of 9/11, we have defined terrorism essentially as our biggest problem, the biggest national security problem facing the United States. If you look at deaths, including deaths in the United States, deaths of American citizens, and you look at sort of longer-term threats, things like cartel-related violence in Mexico probably is a lot more serious as a threat. And we give it about 0.001% of our attention right now. In addition to the threats, we obviously have a lot of opportunities.
But every time we've gone after fighting drug threats from outside the United States, we have failed because we haven't done anything about demand in the United States. We provide the money.
I'm with your legalization.
We provide the guns. You can't get rid of the cartels without solving the demand problem in the United States.
I think on this we are agreed.
So we're making progress here. Foreign policy begins at home. Strengthen the U.S. economy. Get rid of drug laws. I'm just going to filibuster through banning the private ownership of weapons, period.
My silence does not equal consent.
No, I understand. Americans love guns, and it really sets us apart from the world. You know, on economic policy point of view, those are our two biggest trading partners, Canada and Mexico. If we focused all of our efforts on improving our trading relationships and removing barriers between Canada and Mexico, we will produce more immediate benefit than TPP and TTIP added up together. And it's just not glamorous, so people don't want to go and do it, but it's definitely a place to work. Dealing with the border issues is the only way that we can be secure. And if we had functioning borders, there are other things that also could come from that. We could share our resources better. Not just energy resources, but human resources. You know, the United States has an aging population, and we have a problem paying for health care. We allowed Social Security to be portable, Medicare to be portable, so that if you needed to go and be in a rehab center, you could be in a rehab center in Guadalajara, where you could get the care for much less. You would stimulate the Mexican economy. You would take a burden off the U.S. economy. There are all sorts of things that we could do if we put our heads to it.
I agree.
So we start with North America. Would be really novel. By the way, I had breakfast once with several times, but in this particular instance with Cam Kerry, John Kerry's brother. It was right before Kerry was starting as Secretary of State. And he said, where should my brother go on his first trip? And I made the case for Mexico. I think we have to start with business at home. I think that's a big deal. What else? Hillary Clinton going to be? You know, she'll be sitting there looking at her cabinet. Secretary of Defense Flournoy will be on one side of her. Secretary of State Burns.
Here's another piece that depends crucially on congressional cooperation is radically revitalizing economic, cultural, scientific, and economic exchanges of varying sorts globally. You know, during the Cold War, the U.S. invested quite significantly both in the sort of longer-term educational infrastructure to support our foreign policy priorities at the time, screwed up as they may have been, e.g. area studies and linguistic studies at American colleges and so forth. We also invested very heavily in the old U.S. Information Agency and USAID, recognizing development as a tool for achieving foreign policy ends. And we have really scaled back those programs since then. But I think, you know, part of the challenge and part of the reason, in addition to just cravenness, that we're resisting your call, David, to be really specific, is that we have no idea even 18 months from now, which countries, which issues are going to be the hot ones. But what we do know is that we don't know. And we do, and that that actually has some implications of its own.
But we also,
not knowing means that you invest across the board in creating the linkages and getting the...
But we also know other things you said. You said our influence is diminished. You said there are going to be a lot of threats. You described the landscape pretty well. And what that means is that we need to prepare for that. And in order to prepare for a world where we can't do it all ourselves, we need to identify who's going to do it with us. And we need to identify what the modalities for working with them are.
Even doing that means investing in those interpersonal relationships at every different level and investing in those linguistic and cultural expertise. Otherwise, we do it badly and we pick the wrong partners, which we've done from time to time.
I agree. I think those are important things to do. But one of the reasons that I would put revitalizing the transatlantic relationship and coming up with a new Pacific architecture right at the top of the list is that's the way that we find the diplomatic mechanisms, the military cooperation that allows us to burden share our way into solutions as opposed to unilaterally arriving at those solutions, and creates mechanisms that promote dialogue, and it enhances our leverage in certain kinds of discussions that are likely to come up by bringing many people to the table instead of just one. And on top of that, long time ago, we said we're going to work within the international system, and we haven't done a very good job of it. And if we start walking the walk as well as talking the talk, then we're going to end up with more respect and an easier time in dealing with those things. So I think those things go at the top of the list, just like I think dealing with North America has got to go to the top of the list. I also think going and repairing broken relationships, because there has been a lot of trust lost during this administration, just by the way, as there was during the one before it, it is an important part of what we've got to do. I think something else is going to happen in the first 100 days. And that other thing that's going to happen is that somebody is going to challenge the new administration. They are going to test them and say, is this the Obama administration? Is this the Bush administration? Is this some other analog, or is this something entirely new? And this administration is going to have to know how it's going to respond. It's going to have to say, we need to send a stronger message, be more decisive, whatever it is that they want to say, they're going to have, because the test will come. And, ironically, of course, the person who noted this in 2008 was Joe Biden, who said that Obama was going to be tested. Of course, he later went on to live through all of those tests, and they continue to this day. I mean, testing Obama's limits is the game plan of some of the biggest and most important rivals we face in the world. Is there likely to be a major discernible difference between a new Republican president in 2017 and a new Democratic president in 2017? Or, as is usually the case, is the foreign policy going to be pretty much the same?
My guess is that the foreign policy will be pretty much the same for a couple of reasons. First, the structural factors that constrain the range of choice, our national debt, the ability of Congress and the president to get on the same sheet of music about anything, those structural factors typically argue for more continuity than we pretend actually exists. Second of all, Hillary Clinton as the presumptive Democratic nominee doesn't sound that much different from the top 8 or 10 Republicans in the
scrum. On certain issues, although...
On many foreign policy issues, right? She keeps saying that she is a continuation of the Obama administration, but she's for airstrike. She's for creating a safe zone in Syria. She's for a lot of things
conservative. Right, that's pure fig leaf. The reality is she wouldn't be much like the Obama administration in some key respects. And you pick that up when she went and she did her testimony in front of the Benghazi committee, and you go and you read the paragraph in that thing, and it just says, we have discovered what happens when America refuses to step in and lead. Opportunists come in and take advantage of the situation. It was an absolute broadside at Obama inertia.
Yes, I agree. And she was genuinely brilliant. She cultivated the exact right air of weary acceptance of her fate in front of
I don't think that was a cultivated air. I think she was wearily acceptant of her fate.
And
also a complete master of the issues.
Yes.
And you get these nitwits from the Congress who are sitting there making up cases, pounding the table, doing it all emotional.
That said.
And she was able to respond to everything.
I agree with that. And yet she has a credibility problem because, for me, the big Libya question is actually, where was the phase four? Where was the plan for what happens in Libya once you do this?
And well, I'm not 100% sure that that's her responsibility. I think the president didn't want to do something. He got pressured by some members of his team to do something, but he did it in an Obama way. He said, okay, good luck to you. And he limited it. And what happened in limiting it was he ensured its failure, thus enabling him to go and say, see, you should never do that again. I don't think that's her credibility.
President.
And by the way, she has to run against somebody, right? And, you know, we can go through the seven dwarfs who are sort of, you know, out there for her to run against. But, you know, there is not one of them who has any credibility on these issues. Not a single one. I mean, Kasich is pretty good on domestic economic issues. In fact, I think he may be the class of the field in terms of that. But Trump is incredible. Carson's not credible. Cruz is out of his mind.
Credible vis-a-vis whom? The rest of the world or the American population?
No. More important, me. Credible in my eyes. Because, you know, Rubio was there 4 years. Rubio is an Obama clone. Jeb Bush is increasingly look like he needs, you know, Geritol or something to restore a little bit of bounce in his step. He's semi-coherent on these issues, but actually not as coherent. He's less prepared than I would have thought he was going to be on these things. The rest of these characters don't even, you know, Bobby Jindal and, you know, Mike Huckabee and Rand Paul and you know, they don't even exist, right? They're not even really in the mix. Right now, it's Carson, Trump, Rubio, Bush, Kasich. Maybe you could throw in Cruz into that. Take them all together, put them in a blender, add a bunch of foreign policy fortifier, and you'll still have a Republican foreign policy milkshake that is nowhere nearly as potent as what Hillary Clinton can deliver.
I just can't get past the put them all in a blender part.
I don't know if it makes any difference, though, David.
I'm not that delusional.
Well, but
you
but,
just said it makes a difference. You said none of them will be as good as Hillary Clinton.
No, I don't think they will be. But I'm saying, I thought you meant to the American people.
No, I actually mean to how a next administration responds to the first test that comes along, whatever that test may be. And I think that especially early and especially if it's not Hillary Clinton. You know, I think Hillary is going to feel pretty strongly that she can make her own decisions. She can take advice, but she can make her own decisions. She's been Secretary of State. She's been a senator, et cetera. I think any of the Republicans who ends up, if one of them ends up in the White House, if there is an early test, they're going to look to their team. You know, so it doesn't really make that much difference. Their experience or lack thereof, it probably is going to depend who's in that inner circle. And they certainly can assemble some experienced people. But it is probably correct to say that whether it's Hillary Clinton or one of the Republicans, they will both, as Corey said, face the same structural constraints responding to an early test and face the feeling within those constraints of thinking we have to respond in a fairly tough manner because otherwise we're going to set
right.
the tone for the
so
next
So here's
few
the
years.
Message.
However,
if you're a world leader listening to this podcast,
go act fast.
Act before the new administration takes place because whoever moves first is going to get smacked harder than they would have been and probably harder than they might otherwise be.
But just to emphasize one thing, though, the fact that I think that both a Democratic or a Republican administration, if faced with an early test, that there aren't going to be a lot of partisan differences in the response. There can't be for political reasons, for structural reasons. That doesn't mean that the next 4 years wouldn't be different under a Democrat and under a Republican. I think that the first test, whatever it is, they'll have to respond in a very reactive way. almost by definition, obviously. And that doesn't mean that we wouldn't, over the next 4 years on a range of different issues, see substantial differences between the two parties in how they steer us on. Well, on issues such as restoring the Atlantic architecture. And what does that mean? Everybody is going to say nice things about Europe. Everybody's going to say, Europe, we love you. You're our friend. You are our natural friend. I suspect that Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee, is likely to invest more actual energy, diplomatic time, and resources into rebuilding some of the underlying institutions that are part of that relationship than certainly some of the Republicans would do over several years.
Jeb Bush probably would do this.
Jeb Bush might. Donald Trump, I'm not so sure. Donald Trump, maybe not.
You know, seriously, folks, anyone out there, come to collect your one-ounce piece of U.S. gold bullion at Foreign Policy in the event that Donald Trump is elected president of the United States. Okay? This just isn't going to happen.
If he's not, are you
going to
share that bullion between the three of us?
No, that doesn't exist. No. It's one of those bold, empty statements. But the reality is he can't be elected. He can't, you know, he right now, he's been out there for like 6 months, pounding his chest, flopping his orange hair around, you know, talking his ridiculous huge and, you know, I'd be the most militaristic president that we ever had. You know, that's a good thing. How do you think I look? All this kind of idiocy is not going to carry forward right now, even in the Republican Party, a party that is willing to vote for some real nut jobs. And we'll get to Ben Carson in a second. When they look at Donald Trump, they go, 67% of them or 70%, they say, no way. You know, he's leading with a fraction of a fraction. And so essentially, if you do the math and he is 20% of the Republican Party, that's 1/10 of the U.S. electorate. It's just nothing. Meanwhile, Ben Carson, who looks like a guy who's on Thorazine, you know, I mean, he's like, oh, I'm Ben Carson. And everybody's like, oh, he's a very nice guy. He's very soft-spoken. He's not soft-spoken. He nearly killed somebody. He's obviously got a wildly bad temper. He went to a shrink. The shrink said, take these pills, you know, and you can't handle another outburst like your last outburst. And so he's going around and he's very moderate. When he gets home, he kicks his cat. The guy, he's cracked. This is like crazy season. None of these guys are going to be president of the United States.
I do think people are pushing aside the boredom of a potential Bush v. Clinton presidential race by indulging in the fun of a lot of craziness because there are no consequences.
No, it's right. It's just literally Donald Trump for president is like going, can you imagine if Kim Kardashian was president of the United States? Well, think of how cool the White House would be decorated and they'd have great parties and Kanye, wow, you know, it's not going to happen, right? When even if Kanye thinks he's the next Trump, it's not going to happen. But it's also not going to be Bush. It's going to be Marco Rubio and John Kasich one way or another. One's on top, one's on the bottom, one's on the bottom, one's on the top. That's the team. You've heard it here first. Do you disagree? Can you disagree?
I'll take that wager, actually.
You're going to take Jeb Bush.
I will bet you on that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And Rosa?
I'm not a betting person, David. You know that.
I don't know that.
Very
in fact,
virtuous.
I know that you've been to Gamblers Anonymous ever since you were about 11 years old.
I am studiously avoiding following the Republican primaries. I am so careful. When I see
Turn
an
off
article
the TV,
in the newspaper,
when your children
I
are
immediately
looking.
Cover it. Yeah. So I can't comment on this because I don't want to know.
You don't want to know
well,
what's going on.
Well, and to be honest,
I think that is
I certainly feel that way about all primaries,
sensible,
I have to admit.
A sensible position and an ethical position, right? Like, I don't want to
When you guys make up your mind, just let me know.
Yeah, it's really true. If you are listening to this at home, if you are listening to this in your car going to work, and you are like, oh, my God, the primaries, it's so exciting, I'm so wrapped up in it. You're not taking it serious. You're not taking it seriously in the way a professional would take it seriously. If you live in a state where there's a primary, you have to vote. You have to think about it. But the rest of it is nonsense. Iowa is particular nonsense. Iowa elects insanity, okay? Rick Santorum won in Iowa. Pat Robertson won in Iowa. These people could win nowhere else. Okay? You know, you win in Iowa for believing in a certain form of evangelical Christianity. It's a very weird place. New Hampshire, incredibly idiosyncratic. So what are these places? They're kind of high publicity filters that get rid of a couple of bottom tier candidates before you start going to the real races that take place in larger states in the South. And yeah. and all this stuff beforehand is like, I don't know, it's all the analogies I think of are inappropriate for a podcast.
And inappropriate for a podcast in which you debated the suitability of the Canadian prime minister.
No, we didn't. We debated the use of the word fuckable. And we came to the conclusion that the
He's
one thing...
He's having a good time.
We came to the conclusion that you can't say fuckable in a podcast.
For our listeners who are disturbed by this, I just want to
who
say
believe
that
this
David,
podcast
David
is tobogganing
is
downhill.
Tourette syndrome, and he can't help it. And we're just going to pretend to hear that.
All right. Well, then they'll just pull the plug. Let's just pull the plug on this episode of
we're
the
done.
Podcast. We're done with this one. We'll be back with another one soon. And if you can stand the foul language and the ill-tempered guests,
and
you know,
the proposal
come
to
back.
Put the Republicans in a blender.
Put them
that
in a blender.
Nice.
No, that's positive. That may be the best proposal we've come up with here. If you can stand on any of that, come back sometime again in the future. Bye. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe, please visit foreignpolicy.com. And thank you very much for joining us.